Okay, welcome back. Our number two with Joseph Foster. Remarkable information about Bell Labs. This is a really huge story. What we can do this hour is whatever you'd like. I'd like to hear some more about your sightings, your personal experiences, if you want to share some of those.
Sure.
I
didn't send the document off, but my wife has been kind of, I don't know, I guess it's one of those things you kind of drip through from one thing to another.
Right.
There's a flow to life. And
drip
for
through.
Me,
I have never heard that one before. Dripping Through Life with Joe Foster. Now, there's a good book title, right?
Yeah, it sounds like it. Maybe I'll have to sit down and try to write one someday. But anyway, it kind of goes back. My mother had an IQ of 165. She was a city girl. She was born and raised in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And she was had a scholarship to Cooper Union. And she was also, with a 165 IQ, you kind of operate on a different frequency than, most other people. And, of course, with her family, it was the same thing. We were not on the same frequency all the time. Anyway, she decided early on, before I was born, that she wanted to become a farmer. Now, she was a city girl. Hmm. And my dad got out of the Navy. He was a yeoman chief in the Navy. Mm-hmm. He got out, and they got married, and she convinced my father, who came from coal mining country, that he should become a farmer. And they actually tried. They bought a farm, and then I was born. And but, you don't start at the top, especially with farming. You have to spend years learning how to do it.
Yeah.
So my father decided that he needed to apprentice himself. So he took jobs at various farms, usually large farms, and it seemed like they were owned by very wealthy people, gentleman farmer type deal. And they actually moved to Clinton, New Jersey. And I was just barely, probably about 2 years old at the time.
Uh-huh.
Now, the reason I mention this is that Highbridge is part of Clinton Township.
Highbridge.
Highbridge, and that's where Menger's.
Howard.
Yeah, they both live there. Now, interestingly, Howard's second wife, Connie, she went to school she grew up in Elizabeth as well as my mother. And they went to the same all-girls high school together, which is Barton School. But she graduated 2 years before my mom, and they didn't know each other. But somehow we all ended up in that place, at least briefly. And then we moved to East Hampton from there, basically. And I was about 2.5 years old.
Well, by the way, if I might, Howard Menger was mm-hmm. the gentleman who had the UFO group, and that is where Valiant Thor and his two friends, crew members, whatever, showed up and had their pictures taken. We've got photos of it, so that was a wild one in the 1950s. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, anyway, so we moved to East Hampton, and the first event in my life, I was about 2.5, I guess, and I remember standing in my crib. My crib was located in my parents' room. We were living on a farm in East Hampton at the time. And it was owned by the Gould family, who was a big name, I guess, in early Wall Street days or whatever. But anyway, my crib was in my parents' bedroom, and it was at the foot of the bed on my mother's side, and my headboard was away from the bed, and the foot of the crib was against the bed. And I remember standing leaning against the headboard and looking, and there was this creature. It was a hideous creature, white face, black eyes. It was almost a character of a doll. And all I remember is sitting there staring at it, but not being afraid, just staring at it, and it was staring back at me. And that lasted maybe seconds, a couple of seconds. And then nothing. I don't remember going to sleep. I don't remember getting up. I don't remember anything from that point forward. And then about 2 years later, 3 years later, my parents took us to a brand new drive-in theater in Bridgehampton, Bridgehampton's a couple miles to the west of East Hampton. And it was facing, the screen was actually facing further west in the direction of basically the National Lab, Brookhaven National Lab, which is about 20 or 30 miles away. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting in the front seat of the car with my sister, who was a couple years younger than me, and we were watching the movie, and behind the screen, at the top of the screen, was this real bright white light, and it made a zigzag, three zigs. It was three zigs, and it disappeared behind the screen, and it was so fast, and there were right-angle turns, 90-degree turns.
This is indoors?
No, it was outdoors. It was at a drive-in theater.
Oh, a drive-in theater. All right,
and,
sorry.
Yeah, in Bridgehampton. It was right on old Route 27 there, the old Montauk Highway. And then a couple more years go by, and we're living on another farm. And yeah, that's when Sputnik went up in October of, I guess,
1957.
Yeah. And my mother, being the artist that she was, decided that her son was going to be an artist, although she wanted me to become an engineer type of thing. And I used to like drawing, and I draw rockets all the time. I loved rockets. So I would draw rocket designs, you know, using rudimentary mechanical tools. And my mother actually sent him off to Redstone Arsenal. All right, now here's a kid, nine years old. And but at the time, it was kind of interesting. After Sputnik, there was this big panic, and everybody was saying, well, we have a shortage of engineers, Next thing you know, I got a package from Redstone Arsenal, and it had a cover letter on it, and then it had a white paper package about the Jupiter C. Okay, but the letter, interestingly, was signed by Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley. Play, whatever his
Willy
name
Ley.
Is.
Willy Ley, yeah.
Right. So that was kind of cool. You know, here's a kid, you know, and believe me, I was no scientist, no engineer. I just liked drawing. But the interesting thing is that another letter went off to the school I was in. And next thing you know, they're pushing me along. They're asking me to talk about rockets to the class and everything else. And there were other kids that this was happening to, too. One of them that I met was truly brilliant. I mean, this guy was like, you know, he was the real deal. And but he got pushed through. And all the way through high school, they were putting me into either remedial reading classes or accelerated science classes. They couldn't make up their mind what I was. And so anyway, by 1958, I'm living on a farm adjacent to the Navy Road in Colts Neck. That's where I had my first real sighting. I mean, it'd sink your teeth into the sighting. And that was a silver sphere with flashing red and white lights all around it, not connected to it. They were like orbiting this thing. And it was flying maybe 20, 30 miles an hour, following the Navy Road, coming from the pier area, heading towards the storage facility, which is about 3 miles away. And my whole family saw it, and the other people that lived on the farm saw it. And my father ran into the house, and he tried calling Fort Monmouth, but he couldn't get through the switchboard. Mm-hmm. It was jammed up. Mm-hmm. But nothing ever came of it. I never saw anything in the newspaper about it, never heard anything about it, until years later, okay, in like 1997. But before that, 11 years down the road, I joined the Coast Guard, and I have my first sighting in 1969 in the Coast Guard of three objects that flew from the horizon to horizon in about 7 seconds.
You're out at sea.
Out at sea on what's called Ocean Station Victor, which is 34 degrees north latitude by 165 east longitude.
Okay,
so we're west of the international date line, and we're just sitting on the station. It's a 10-square-mile area, and we're aid to navigation. We had a doctor on board with an operating room, and we had a flight deck that could accommodate a helicopter. And we just sat there for 25 days on station, and it was about 20 days out and back from Honolulu. My ship was out of Honolulu. Well, anyway, so radar is the one, actually Combat Information Center, the radar operator is the one that picked up the objects closing on the ship. And they said, well, these objects are traveling at 3,500 miles per hour.
Oops.
But they gave us the direction, the bearing that they were coming from.
Uh-huh.
And we were in the middle of a shift change, and a mid-watch was coming. I was ongoing, going on mid-watch.
Right.
And we were relieving the guys that were on there, you know, for the watch before. So there were about 14 of us on the bridge at the time, including the captain. The captain was there. The OD was there.
Uh-huh.
His replacement. The quartermaster of the watch was there. His replacement. And the rest of us. And so what happened, when they squawked, it was about 11:45, we all go running out to the starboard bridge wing, and sure enough, you can see three points of light picked up on the horizon, flying over the ship and disappearing. You have to run through the bridge out to the port bridge wing to watch them disappear.
Right.
So they were coming out of the northeast, heading on a southwesterly course. And a couple of the officers on the bridge broke out the slide rules, and they started doing some spherical trig, and they figured that the speed was about 3,200 miles per hour. So they had we had corroboration with the visual sighting, as well as the radar. And the radio officer, a couple minutes later, the radio officer, who was a JG, came up on deck with a sighting report in his hand. He took it over to the captain. The captain signed off on it. He went back down to the radio shack, and then we never heard anything more about it.
Hmm.
Okay, so now we come back. I come back, and this is we're back in port, and it's around August of 69, and we got our orders that we would be deploying to Vietnam in January.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go under underway training at Pearl Harbor, and that was 2 weeks of training. And then we deployed in January, and I'm out there, and we're doing our normal thing, part of Operation Market Time. We're chasing trawlers. We're providing shore bombardment. You know, we had med caps going up the rivers and everything else like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now we get to, it's probably around May, and we were anchored a couple miles off the south coast of Vietnam, just where the South China Sea meets the Gulf of Siam. And we were anchored, and I was on anchor watch at the time. I was a quartermaster by this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the anchor watch, and there were four of us up on the bridge, and we had a couple of people up on the flying bridge as shark guards. They had M16s, and the captain authorized swim call. So we had the crew was diving off the main deck in the aft third of the ship, and they'd swim over to a raft and climb up a cargo net and do it all over again.
Hmm.
So while we're watching this, we're looking down. I'm 44 feet above the sea level on the bridge wing, on the port
right.
bridge wing
right.
now. I even have a picture. They have a picture. We didn't get a picture of the object because the water conditions and everything else, you couldn't get a good picture of it. But we're all out on the bridge wing watching this, and all of a sudden, underneath the ship, there was this big, dark object. It was teardrop shape. And we knew the ship I was on was 378 foot long and was about 35, 40 foot wide.
Right.
So we had a way of estimating the size of what we were looking at. What we were looking at was over 100 feet long.
Now, what time of day was this about?
This was, I'm going to say, probably around early afternoon.
Okay. So it's clear, bright, sunny. No question.
No, it wasn't. That's
what was that day like?
Uh-huh. The day was overcast, okay?
Right.
But the sun was burning through, but it was overcast. And there was a 5-knot wind, so you had a slight chop to the water.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Now, when you're looking straight down alongside the ship, which it came from the starboard side, swam underneath the keel, and passed on the port side and headed off at a right angle to the ship. We saw the whole teardrop shape. We got the size of it, and then it went basically underneath where all the men were swimming. Okay.
Unreal.
Yeah,
right, was it just a dark shape deep in the water?
Teardrop shape deep in the water. Well, it had to be deep because the keel of the ship right there is about 17 foot 6 inches.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it cleared underneath the ship, so that puts it down probably around 20 feet.
Wow.
Okay, and the water conditions on the South China Sea and the Gulf of Siam, you know, within a couple miles of the coast, it's
yeah.
not real clear. It's not that deep blue where you can see down 200 feet out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. But we had this good, a good shape of it. Matter of fact, I went running into the bridge to get out our Bible. We have Jane's Ships of the World.
Yeah.
And it had all the warships and submarines and everything else.
Yeah, you wouldn't find one like
version.
That. Yeah.
We immediately thought it was probably some type of submarine. It was too big to be a whale. It was too big to be a whale shark. So we're down there. We're trying to identify what type of submarine would have that shape.
How many of you saw it about, do you think? What, how many witnesses?
There were the four of us looking down the picture.
Yeah.
And then there was two people up on the bridge, the two gunners.
How many guys were on the water, do we think?
I'm going to say there were probably about 20 guys in the water at any one time.
And they had to shoot sharks from time to time, huh?
No, they didn't. No, no sharks ever showed up.
I see.
I mean, there were more sea snakes, poisonous sea snakes in that area than there were sharks, probably. Yeah, they were orange and black snakes. They're pretty looking, but they're also pretty deadly.
Yeah.
So, but we didn't see any of those. And they swam, and they didn't know anything about it, and they came back. So there were only basically like six of us that saw this thing.
Uh-huh.
Everybody else was off duty, and they were doing their thing. I have an interesting picture of it, of the four of us in the swim call, and whoever took the picture decided that they needed to get in to let you know that there was something down there. So what they did, they made a shadow of the Loch Ness Monster, and it's in the ship's cruise book. I could send you that, and you can see it for yourself if you want.
That'd be fun. Well, very interesting.
But anyway, so that was the second sighting when I was in the Coast Guard. The third one took place about a month later.
Mm-hmm.
We were now finished with our tour, Westpac tour, and we were leaving Guam, heading back to Honolulu, and I was about a day and a half out of Guam. We had passed the Marianas Trench. And my job as a quartermaster, I was a navigator. So myself and my chief were working stopwatches for the captain and the OD, who actually had the sextants, and we were shooting morning stars. Now, morning stars takes place a half hour before sunrise. Evening stars is a half hour after sunset. It's like daylight. It's just that you need a clear horizon with no sun to block it. So we're out there, and I was on the starboard bridge wing. The four of us were on the starboard bridge wing, and we're heading back to Honolulu, so roughly on an east-northeasterly course. And all of a sudden, on a reciprocal course coming straight at us, was this big sphere of, like, pure mercury. It wasn't aluminum. It wasn't silver. It was like a drop of mercury.
Time of day?
This was about 5:30 in the morning, local ship's time.
And this is illuminated?
No illumination. It was strictly a ball of mercury.
Really?
Okay, and I say mercury, the reflective characteristics were that of a mirror. Only
that's like chrome,
sphere.
Right? Chrome.
Pardon me?
It's like chrome, almost.
Chrome would have imperfections. This had no imperfections in it. There were no rivets. There were no windows. There was nothing other than this perfect sphere.
When you first acquired it, how far away from the ship was it? Let me ask you to put your arm out in your mind's eye, and what would you hold between your thumb and index finger? How big was this thing?
When we first saw it, I'm going to say it was about the size of an eraser.
All right.
Okay, and then it came straight at us. Now, I'm on the starboard bridge wing with my captain, the OD, and my chief.
Wow.
And, they took we all four of us saw it, and I'm sure the lookout saw it as well.
Yeah.
They put their sextants down. We're watching the thing as it approaches the ship, and then it's still on a straight course, but it's...
How high? Off the water.
Size for me, I'm always having a little trouble with size. I'm going to say it was probably either 500 to 1,000 feet, depending on how far away it was. It looked like it was very, very close, but we were on the starboard side,
right.
And it passed us on the port side.
All right, when it goes by, what was the shape?
It was about two-thirds of the way up my forward mast. That's where it passed.
And let's give me an idea of how big it is, approximately.
When it got close to us, I'm going to say it was probably about the size of a marble.
So what are people saying? I mean, that you can repeat on the program.
Well, I'm sitting there, I'm flabbergasted. Now, I already know that, you know, what we saw, those three bright points of light, that was reported. I said, oh, there's no way the captain's not going to report this one. This is really a solid object. It's very close, and, you know, it's very describable.
Uh-huh.
All he did, he looked at it, he shrugged his shoulder and went back, put his sextant back up to his eye, and continued shooting morning stars. It was never reported. Matter of fact, I couldn't even log it. Okay, I kept the ship's log at that time. Quartermaster also kept the ship's log.
He must have gotten some grief for the earlier report somehow. Just knock it off, maybe?
Somehow I don't think so, because the JANUP's 146E was the controlling mechanism. Okay, and all U.S. naval ships, and the Coast Guard is a naval ship, and at the time we were still, our change of operations was to the Navy, so I was in the Navy at the time, but also Coast Guard cutters have reported objects. One or two got into Project Blue Book, but if it's reported formally, it never would have gotten to Blue Book.
So this thing comes by, this marble-sized object. Perfectly round, perfectly mercury in color.
Here's the reflective uh-huh. The thing that got me was the reflective quality of it. Now, you have to understand, I had probably maybe a 10% cloud cover at the time.
Yeah.
Blue skies, beautiful South Pacific morning. And then the Pacific Ocean was that Pacific Ocean blue. Absolutely gorgeous, with slight white caps. There was maybe a 3 to 5 knot wind, so you had a little bit of white cap activity. And what happens when the sphere got closer, you could see the reflection of the sky on the top of it, including clouds, and on the bottom of it, you could see the reflection of the ocean, including the white caps.
Oh, that's remarkable.
To me, was absolutely unique.
Yeah, that is amazing. Well,
yeah.
Three excellent sightings.
Yeah. And those are the three that I talked to the yeoman from ThicPac about. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that he laughed at me. Because in retrospect, what has been reported, what has actually gotten out, and he told me, he said, we have objects flying out of the water, we have them flying into the water, we have them flying up into space. They had the whole thing. And it's been that way for years. I mean,
decades. Or more.
Probably over 100, I'm going to say 100 years. The Navy, the first Navy sighting that I'm aware of was the USNS Supply out of San Diego. And Frank Schofield, who was, I believe, a JG at the time.
Right.
He was on board the Navy ship Supply, and they had, and it's funny, I reread the report on it. They were kind of like shaped, oval-shaped objects, three of them, that flew over the ship and then took off up into the air. This is in 1905.
Yeah, we've been, well, look, 4.5 billion years of existence, this planet.
Right.
We've been visited probably forever, since the beginning, as soon as it cooled down enough to warrant somebody to get close to take a look. This is such a populated universe, it's crazy. Our galaxy is loaded with life. They're coming here and going. They may have bases all over the planet. We don't know.
Yeah.
It would make sense. If they want to have a base here, they'll have a base here.
Yeah.
We ignore it. We just leave them alone. By the way, you mentioned the Mengers, Howard Menger and Connie.
Connie Menger, right.
I didn't know this, but Howard Menger died in 2009, and
yep.
Connie Menger just died last year.
Yep. Matter of fact, about a year and a half ago, I tried reaching out. I wanted to find out if she remembered my mother. Okay,
right,
so
right.
I called the number. They had a Facebook page, and there was a phone number on it.
The Mengers did?
Yes, and I called that number, and a woman answered, and I said, oh, I think I must have the wrong number. I said, I'm trying to get in touch with Connie Menger. And she said, well, I'm a friend of Connie's, and she said, why do you want to speak with her? And I explained. I said, my mother, you know, was born and raised in Elizabeth and went to Barton High School, and I just wanted to find out whether Connie might have known her. know.
Sure.
And she said, well, she'll check. And I didn't talk with her directly, but she called me back a couple days later, and she said, no, she said, Connie's 96 years old. Or, no, she was 90, yes, I think she was about 96 years old. My
96,
mom just passed
yeah.
away this year, mm-hmm. and she was 93. So, 95, 96. She was roughly 2 years older than my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said she went to, because I wanted to make sure she went to the same high school and everything. So she said, yeah, she went to Barton High School or whatever the woman's high school was in Elizabeth.
Yeah.
But that was about it. And then I never had a chance to talk with her because, like you said, she just passed away not too long ago.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay. Will you mention, let's see here. Hold on. Frank wanted you to mention a story. Let's see. Here we go. Ask Joe about his FBI and military pilot that validates George Filer's story about the McGuire incident wherein a visitor, an alien, was shot January 8th, 1978.
Right. Okay. Basically, remember I mentioned there's a synchronicity, and I was basically going to let, you know, see if George wanted to talk about it. My own, the thing I came across for myself was from 1982 through 85, I worked for the FBI. And it was tech services. I was not an agent, so you know, that was not my gig. And around 1986, 87, I first read about George's sighting, the alien that was shot on the runway. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, it kind of snapped. When I first got out of the service, I was an athletic director at Fort Monmouth.
Right.
I took a job as an athletic director there. And one night, I was working until 10 o'clock at the field house, the post field house. And about 8 o'clock in the evening, it's slow, but it, you know, so I'm sitting out in the lobby just kind of relaxing, waiting for something to happen. And a buddy of mine came up. Now, the local RAs all exercised at the field house, the resident agents for the local office. And so the one agent I became friendly with, a very gregarious guy, very nice guy. He was a ice hockey player for Boston College the year they won the national championship. You know, he's always joking around, just a real, real nice guy. Well, anyway, he comes walking up the steps, and it's in January of 78. And he walked in, and he had his top coat on, you know, his top coat. And he was no longer a very jovial guy. He looked like he had seen a ghost. And so I said, hey, John, I said, what's the matter? You look like you've seen a ghost. And all he said to me was, they shot someone on a military base. Then he never said another word about it. And I knew, you don't ask. I mean, that was something serious. And he probably, you know, didn't want to talk about it, or he couldn't, or whatever.
Okay, well, how do you think John knew about that?
Well, first of all, you know, military bases are federal. Even though they may not have jurisdiction, they would probably be called in because George told me on Wednesday, he said the state police were brought in when the incident first happened. So if state police were brought in, the FBI would have an interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure who the closest RA, resident agent office would have been, but he definitely had something, some knowledge of something. Now, I immediately thought when he said someone, he did not say something. He said someone was shot on a military base. Didn't say they died. He just said they were shot. And I immediately thought that somebody tried to break into Earl, maybe to blow up one of the bunkers where the nukes were held or something like that.
Right.
Well, the next day, there was absolutely nothing in the newspapers. I didn't see anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it never did. From that point forward, there was never anything about it until I saw George's story. And all of a sudden, I started saying, gee, that was awfully close to the same time. And an alien being shot, and he went into detail that the MPs were there. There were four MPs, and
he's told that
whole
here.
Thing,
fascinating.
Well, now about 6 months ago, do you know Bruce Pearson? Have you ever had a chance to talk with Bruce?
I don't think so.
Mm. Well, Frank, I'm sure will be able to set you up with him. Bruce had a fascinating story that he was telling me. He was ex-Coast Guard, so it's like a ring knockers club almost. Anyway, he told me, he knows George real well, and he said, I just came across the guy. He said, we collect cars together. He collects cars, and this other gentleman collects cars, and some very, very expensive and rare cars. Well, anyway, he said his friend was a pilot with the Air Force, but he also flew apparently at some point for the CIA. And he said that he told the story to Bruce that he flew into McGuire Air Force Base the morning of the incident. Now, I'm not sure he was a pilot or he was a passenger on the plane. But anyway, the plane lands at McGuire, and the air traffic control tell them not to deplane until they're told to. So they had to stay on the plane. Now, George never knew anything about this before. But anyway, they were told to stay on the plane. But what somebody did, they turned the frequency of one of their radios to the frequency that the MPs were on. And so they heard all the chatter back and forth. So, I mean, that there's two pieces of corroboration. There's a synchronicity to it. One thing took place 10 years later. Another thing took place almost 25 or 30 years later. It was kind of the same thing with the sighting I had on the Navy Road. I never saw anything in the paper about it. Never knew anybody other than the people that were on the farm that knew anything about it. And then in 1997, we were putting together, we were starting up an arts council in the city of Long Branch.
A community arts council.
It was a Council of the Arts. It was the Greater Long Branch Council of the Arts, what we were putting together. And one of the volunteers that worked at Fort Monmouth at the time was a savant when it came to movies. I mean, he knew everything there was to know about movies, movie theaters, equipment, everything. As a matter of fact, he was a consultant. He was used as a consultant when they made the Titanic, the movie Titanic. Well, anyway, so he is, I'm telling him the story, and all of a sudden he said, yeah, I saw that. Matter of fact, it landed. I said, what do you mean it landed? Well, it turns out I lived in Colts Neck, and about 4 miles to the north, there is another little town, and it's called River Plaza. It's part of Middletown Township. But River Plaza is right on the Navisink River, where it runs into the Swimming River, which comes from the reservoir. And there's a big marshy area, swampland marshy area, that surrounds the river on both sides. No houses close by. His house is up on the hill facing this area. And he said, yeah, he said he saw it land in this marshy area, stay on the ground for about 5 minutes, and then it took off again, heading to the south, heading in the direction of my farm, the farm I lived on. So that was the only time, what was that, almost 30 years later, whatever, 20, 30 years later, get corroboration of an event. Now, there were other landings, too, that were investigated, newspaper articles, pictures of, flattened grass area, circular grass area where
A lot of those back then.
Yeah, quite a few of those. Well, there was one in Port Monmouth, which is only about a mile and a half away from the Navy Pier. And it's also only about a mile and a half away from the Nike site that blew up. Here is synchronicity for you. I was living on the farm, and in May 22nd of 1958, the worst accident in Nike Ajax history took place.
Yes, it did.
Alongside the Navy Road. The site was about maybe 8 miles from my house, but it's right adjacent. The launcher area was right adjacent to that Navy Road, and a launch section of Nike Ajax missiles in a chain reaction blew up, killing 10 men, 6 soldiers, and 4 DOD civilians. Okay. Now, that same month of May 1958, a gentleman named Harlan Bentley, I don't know if you've ever seen the video, part of the Disclosure Project. Harlan Bentley was an electrical engineer that, when he was in the service, he was in the Army in 1958. He was a radar operator.
Oh, he was at the base, or he was at that installation, correct?
Yes, it was I volunteer at New York 56, so it was part of the New York Air Defense System.
I think I might have had him on the program.
Did you really?
I might have. So I had somebody on the program who was either there or knew somebody who was there. We had pictures. We had everything. Anyway.
I think I sent you that. That was part of the Dorbrook story. I had it kind of linked together.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, I have not been able to find anything about Harlan Bentley ever since that video came out. It's still out there. You can see the video.
Huh.
And but the interesting thing was, the way he described it, he was part of Whiskey 93. I was able to validate that Nike site.
Uh-huh.
That Nike site is very, very interesting in today. Whiskey 93 was located in Olney, Durwood, Maryland, a couple miles up the road from Gaithersburg.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, that particular site, when it was finally shut down, I think it was shut down in 1960, they did away with the Nike Ajax, and then everything became Hercules after that. And they didn't keep the site, so it was excess. Now, however, whatever crashed, according to Harlan Bentley's video, it was radioactive. It left behind some radioactive debris that the Air Force came in and took away. And then the Army crew that was at the integrated fire control were all debriefed.
Hmm.
And they were told that it was a test helicopter and that they're not to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
And Harlan uh-huh. Bentley said, you know, they all laughed about it because they knew it was no uh-huh. helicopter.
Right.
Well, anyway, but that site, when it was accessed, it was not sold or turned over to any of the towns, which is normally what happened with those old Nike sites. Instead, it became a FEMA facility, a classified communications facility, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, it still is, apparently. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting aside. Whether or not the story can be corroborated or not, the fact of what that site became, that is true.
Well, it was quite a story, and I forget who was on. Maybe Frank remembers. Frank might even have set it up. We had someone on who was there. I'm pretty sure they were there.
Oh, really?
When that explosion occurred. Yeah, Frank will let me know, but I did a program on this.
No. Well, again, that was me. I mean, the explosion rattled the windows in my house.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when that happened, because it was about 7 miles away.
You were on before.
Yeah.
And you gave us those pictures. That's where the pictures came from. Thank you.
Right.
I remember now. Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
Like I said, I've been trying to find Harlan Bentley because I wanted to talk to him.
Sure.
I still give tours out at the Nike site here, and I'm dying to get more Nike.
Now I remember. Yes. Okay. Got it.
Okay.
Now I remember. I'm sorry. I've interviewed over 20,000 people, and it gets a little blurry after a while.
Yeah.
But I do remember it was a wonderful program, and the pictures were extraordinary. They're in the archives. Just look for Joseph Foster. It's been a couple of years, I think.
Yeah.
But
there was another story that I don't think I did really go into. I mean, I may have just mentioned it casually. Because tonight, I think you wanted to talk about the Spears, too. I don't know if you're familiar with Wanacue Reservoir.
No.
Wanacue Reservoir is up in northern New Jersey, and during World War II, it was heavily fortified. I mean, it was guarded, and again, reservoirs being water supplies, you know,
sure.
You don't want them to be poisoned or whatever.
Yeah.
But over 50 or 60 years, UFOs and orbs have been sighted there on numerous occasions. To uh-huh. this day, they still are.
Huh.
Now, I did have I had something else that I pulled down off the internet in 2000, and it was a chat group, and it had a story about the orbs, and that the Army came in and they were doing an experiment trying to find out what these orbs were, and they set up a bunch of test equipment, and the next morning all the test equipment was burned up. It was destroyed.
Huh.
And the story went on. It got even more interesting. Now, at the time, I was working for AT&T as a project manager, okay, an IT project manager.
Right.
And so I had access. I had my email account and everything else. So I had access to the global directory. And, of course, I had over 100,000 people that worked for AT&T at the time. And so I'm sitting there, and in the story, I can send you the story. I saved the whole blurb so you can see it all.
Mm-hmm.
But in the story, it mentioned that AT&T was very interested in the technology, and they wanted to be part of it or to study it or whatever. And they quoted a gentleman whose name is Jim Eel. I may be mispronouncing that. But anyway, I'm looking, and it said he was some type of a manager for AT&T. And I said, well, I'm going to look this up. So I checked him out, and sure enough, he actually existed in the global directory. Now, I never talk with him. I was tempted, but I figured maybe I better not. May not be the smart thing to do. But it turns out that the orbs are quite intelligent. There's an intelligence associated with them.
Yes. No doubt. Yeah.
Now, when I first came back from Vietnam, after I finished that school, I did something. It was by accident, but it worked out. It was one of those fortuitous things. I wanted to get back to the 3rd District, which is New York, and I knew that my rating was going to guarantee me being put to sea for the rest of my enlistment, probably. But I had 3 offices to paint in Honolulu. I was waiting for a transfer or whatever. And so the 3 offices were the admiral's office, the captain's office, and then a warrant yeoman's office.
You were painting. You were a quartermaster painting.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was a quartermaster. Now I'm a quartermaster 3rd class. Okay. I just finished school. I'm a quartermaster 3rd class, but I had only 3 or 4 months left in district. Uh-huh. So they weren't going to put me on a ship, and they were trying to figure out what to do with me. So I said, well, I'd like to get an early transfer back to New York. That would be great. Well, anyway, I had a selection of offices to paint, and I decided to paint the warrant yeoman's office first, not the captain, not the admiral.
And what color were you painting, Joan?
The color it was supposed to be, the paint they gave me and the brushes and everything else, right. And I masked everything off. I did a perfect job painting, and mm-hmm. I hate painting. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm finishing up. It's around 4 o'clock. I've cleaned up, and I was just getting ready to turn around and leave, and all of a sudden the warrant yeoman comes walking in, and he looks at his room, and his room is all painted. He said, "What happened?" I said, "Well, I just finished painting your room." He said, "Well, are you supposed to do more painting?" He said, "Yeah, I was supposed to paint the admiral's room and the captain's room." He said, "Well, did you paint them first?" I said, "No, I painted you first." So he had a big laugh about it. We sat down, and we started shooting the breeze, and he's asking me about this and that and the other thing. Then he asked me, he said, "Well, where would you want to go? You're a seagoing rating." I said, "Well, I'd really like to have a little land duty if possible." And he said, "Well, that's kind of tough as a quartermaster." I said, "Yeah, it is." And then he said, "Well, where do you want to go?" I said, "Well, I'd like to go back to the 3rd District, New York. You know, that's my home district." He said, well, maybe you can get that. So we shook hands. I walked away, I was never going to see him again. The next morning, I get muster. They call me out, and they tell me to head to headquarters. I head to headquarters, and I pick up this big, thick manila envelope. And it had all types of stuff. It had orders in it. It had basket leave. He gave me 30 days basket leave plus my additional leave. And I had the orders to the Comlant area, which is, you know, I knew I was going to get a ship. But still, and I was told that I had to pack up and get on a plane within like 2 days. At 2 days to fly back. So I flew back, and I sure enough, they put me in an officer's billet, and I was running an operation, a shift supervisor for an operation called Amber, which is Automated Merchant Vessel Emergency Reporting System. And that's what I did until the very end. So the old adage, you don't screw with the person that feeds you, you don't screw with the person that pays you, or the guy that cuts your orders.
This is
the guy that cut those orders, and it was, I couldn't have cut the orders better myself.
True story.
But anyway, I get back, and now it's winter time of maybe 71, and I finish up one of my shifts. I come home. It was an odd shift that I ended up having to work. I got home, and about 3 o'clock, I'm sound asleep, and at 5 after 3, I wake up, and it's a blizzard outside. The wind's howling. The room is perfectly black. Heavy drapes are drawn. And the only light in the room was the iridescent face of the alarm clock. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there, and the room's all black. And all of a sudden, in the upper corner, close to where there's where the wall and the ceiling all join by a closet,
right.
There was a ball of soft white light about the size of a baseball in the corner. And then all of a sudden, it just kind of grew until it was about the size of a basketball. And next thing you know, now whether my eyes were just becoming acclimated or whatever, the whole room lit up. It lit up almost as bright as day. And it stayed that way for about 10 or 15 seconds.
Huh.
And all of a sudden, there was a warm glow. The room was as warm and inviting as you can ever imagine. And I didn't want to move because I was afraid I was going to break the spell or whatever it was.
But you weren't afraid at all. Nothing
not
about
at
this
all.
Game.
Uh-huh. Not in the least. It was. Mm-hmm. It's about as close to a religious experience, I think, as you're going to get.
Yeah.
Anyway, the sphere grew smaller until it was about the size of a baseball again. Then it disappeared, and the whole room went black back to the way it was when I first woke up. But at that point in time, the sense was that my life had changed forever, and that there was nothing to worry about, that, you know, everything would work out the way it's supposed to and all this.
Wow.
And it did. I mean, it was an earth-changing event. Now, what that was, I can't tell you. I can't even begin to tell you.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just that whatever it was, it left,
well, whatever it was,
an,
has been
an
reported.
Impression.
Yes, yes, but it's been reported by other people. Some mm-hmm. people see them moving through a residence, a building, a home. It doesn't matter. Inside,
right.
Outside, they're around. It's like they're an intelligent form of life. Perhaps they live on the planet. We don't know. Maybe they're doing surveillance work. Maybe they're doing scouting work for something else. They might be kind of a probe that's sent out.
Well, that's the reason. I've got to send you this paper that I came across and everything, because it captures the whole thing, but it also explains it all, that these beings are in contact with certain people, not all people.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I'm one of them. I'm not what I'm saying.
Right.
But that they are an intelligent entities. And that they got really angry when the military got involved with them. That's the way the equipment apparently was destroyed, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
But they were also willing to manifest themselves to certain scientists and engineers,
right.
and communicate and share some type of information with them and everything. So to me, it sounds like this may have been what that object was, although I was not brought into any fold in any meaningful manner than what was directly meaningful to me.
Well, that's plenty. So, that's plenty.
Oh, absolutely.
Bell Labs.
I'm thankful for it. Okay.
Bell Labs and Ball Plasma. We've got about 3-4 minutes.
Okay. Well, again, now, that document that I have, mm-hmm. it explains the scientists and engineers. Now, it mentions specifically the Army. Now, to me, the Army in 2000, scientists and engineers would have been from the CERDEC, which is Communications Electronics Command Research and Development Group. But it could have been another group as well. It could have been from somebody like, you know, maybe the NSA or something like that. Whoever does scientific investigation with technology
maybe,
and everything.
Maybe even DARPA,
been,
huh?
Like I said, it could have been a number of different groups mm-hmm. that would have been involved with it like that. Now, there was another incident, and I'm only saying from memory right now, from that document, that there was a conference out in Colorado, and that these entities were actually invited, and that they actually showed up and they manifested themselves, apparently, to a small group of these people that were at this conference or whatever. So now, whether Bell Labs, and I believe the story was that Bell Labs is very interesting. Now, whether they call it ball lightning, or, you know, maybe it was called ball lightning because that's the only thing you can liken it to. Ball lightning can be that soft glowing ball that floats in the air. But I don't think that's what these objects or whatever these things are. And Wanaku Reservoir seems to be a regular base of operations for them, whether it's a vortex. I think they mentioned something about a vortex, that they would manifest themselves where they came in. It was kind of likened to the contact, you know, the way the aliens had their wormhole means of transporting themselves throughout the universe.
Got it.
And that's why this was explained, the vortices that they were talking about, that these beings, whatever these beings were, actually traveled millions of light years almost instantaneously, and they would show up at certain vortices.
Hmm. Well, anything's possible. The universe is certainly more amazing than we can imagine. It's just there's too much going on out there. We don't have a clue, and we're held even further back from reality by the powers that be, who they do know, many of them. You ever wonder, or have you ever spoken to anybody who has a real inside look on how much they, our people, know about all this? They always obfuscate everything, but One wonders.
You know,
contact,
it's always...
official contact is certainly a possibility. That's
yes.
one.
Yeah. The sense I have, there's probably a lot of people that have pieces of the picture.
Yeah.
And they don't talk about it, but you kind of get the sense that there's something close there. You know, exactly what it is, no clue.
I agree.
But yeah, but like I said, it's that mosaic. Every once in a while, you get something like a piece of mosaic. When you hold it in your hand, you can't tell what it is. But when it's part of other things, the further away you can step from it, the more clear the picture comes. It becomes like pixelization. You know, you get to a point where now you have a picture. You know, and yeah. I think that's what's happening. I think that so many people have pieces of this. You know, whether it's being part of teams that have to fly out to areas and pick up
retrieval.
Bodies or,
sure, yeah.
Yeah, the retrieval. There's a lot of people that are talking about that.
Yes.
Can they bring you the cold hard evidence? Well, I think that's where the problem lies.
That is a problem. But again, I don't think we need the government to tell us it's okay to believe and understand and certainly piece together, as you're pointing out, the information that we do have to know that we're not being in any way left alone in this solar system or galaxy. We're visited all the time.
Right, right. And I think it's only a matter of time before, you know, I don't think they're going to be able, well, actually on the other side of the coin, you know, depending on how you see the alien entity in its totality, if it's 1,000 different species and each one with their own, set of motivations, and also their own mores or whatever.
Yeah.
You can't sit there and say one size fits all. You know, everybody's going to love. It's all going to be love, peace, and happiness. You know, there is another aspect that has to be considered, and I think that's what Hawkins was kind of getting at, that we may not want to be so outreaching to them because we don't know. We may be inviting in our own demise.
Well, I think,
or even now. I mean, are you a conspiracy theorist?
And I'm personally a conspiracy researcher.
Yeah, I kind of follow it as well. And to me, everything we see going on, like from a political standpoint, doesn't really make a lot of sense.
No,
at the surface level, it makes no sense.
There's some holes in the linear thought and logic there that if you see. Clearly, you can understand that there's something wrong with the narrative. They're withholding a lot.
Yes. Now the question is why?
Yeah.
And who? What is the motivation?
Exactly. All right. Well, great. We're out of time. We've gone over, and it's been just fun to have you back on again, Joe. Thank you very much.
It's been fun talking with you, Jeff. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. We'll do it again.
Absolutely.
All right. You take care.
You too.
Thank you. Joseph Foster. And fascinating man. All right. We will be back with more after this.